Welcome back to Brain Biohacking with your host, Kayla Barnes. We dive into all things optimal health, optimal brain health, nutrition, peak performance, cognitive excellence, biohacking, longevity, and so much more. Before we get into the episode, I have some exciting news. I have brought on my first podcast sponsor, and this is taking quite some time because I want to make sure that I'm only offering you tools that are the most effective and most worth your time. I've partnered with a brand that I've loved for a long time called Inside Tracker. I'm a big fan of testing your blood biomarkers to understand the current state of your health to then biohack your way to better health. Inside Tracker is an at-home or in-lab blood test that will not only show you your biomarkers based on an optimal range for you, but will also give you an action plan with personalized guidance on the right exercise, nutrition, and supplementation for your body. For a limited time only, you can get 20% off the entire Inside Tracker store. Just go to insidetracker.com/Kayla Barnes. Again, that's insidetracker.com/Kayla Barnes. Thank you for listening and stay tuned. I know you're going to love this episode. Dr. Scott, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Kayla. It's good to be here.
Yeah.
Next to your podcast, red light chamber over there, I think.
Yeah, red light bed. Yeah. I'm in the red light bed. I always preface when I'm doing a podcast that this is not a tanning bed. It's actually the opposite. But this has been a long time coming. We've been talking about doing this podcast, so I'm excited.
Me too.
So today we're going to talk about a bunch of incredible things. So you are an expert in hyperbaric medicine. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely going to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to talk about methylene blue and mm-hmm. the role that it could play in potentially upregulating mitochondria function. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go deep on a bunch of interesting topics. So first, mm-hmm. I would love for you to tell the audience a little bit about your background.
Yeah, sure. So I'm an internal medicine physician. I did go to medical school and I've been out of training now, I guess, over 10 years. I grew up the son of a chiropractor, though. So grew up very out of the box, very much not knowing what conventional medicine was until I went to college. And I think I had to get a physical or something. And I realized what a regular doctor did. So I grew up very out of the box, very alternative. I went to medical school thinking I could find a very high-minded way to bridge the chasm between alternative medicine and conventional medicine. And over the years, I've gravitated to figuring that out. It was certainly not something I knew how it was going to transpire. When I was in medical school working at Shock Trauma Center, actually in Baltimore, seeing shock and trauma, I actually, at that point, experienced hyperbaric oxygen therapy for the first time. I saw patients going in and having these amazing recoveries. And I learned a lot about the acute reasons why we're using hyperbaric therapy at the time. And so after medical school, I did my residency in internal medicine, and then I started specializing in hyperbaric oxygen therapy. I created integrative practice where I use hyperbaric therapy as my main tool. But over the years, I've gravitated to more of an integrative way of understanding foundational health markers and a foundational health practice that works with patients, that looks at not just how a hyperbaric chamber can work with you and how it can benefit you, but how we can really optimize your health over the long term. And so that's a bit about my clinical practice overall.
Very fascinating. And chiropractors are always doing really interesting work, by the way.
I know.
So let's talk about, let's talk about hyperbaric oxygen. What is it? What is the potential at-home application? I actually hear our hyperbaric chamber inflating right now. It's pressurizing, but nice. Talk us through all of this.
Yeah, so hyperbaric therapy has been around a long time. In general, the technology is very simple, and this is what really intrigued me when I was learning about it in medical school. It was just oxygen and pressure. So the amazing thing about the oxygen that we breathe, it's only 21% in the air that we breathe. There's 21% oxygen. Okay. But that does enough to do as much as we need to saturate our red blood cells. About 98% of the sites on red blood cells are saturated with oxygen just by breathing sea level air. Now I'm here in Colorado. I'm at about 16% oxygen, and my body, what it does is at altitude, it's going to secrete a hormone called epigen. This hormone is secreted from your kidneys and increases the number of red blood cells in circulation. And so it increases my red blood cells in circulation. So I have more red blood cells to carry more oxygen at 5,000 feet above sea level, as opposed to being at sea level where you're at 21% oxygen. So we know oxygen's a big deal. Oxygen is the final electron acceptor in your mitochondria. So it helps you make ATP, which is your energy currency. So, but we do a pretty good job of this. 21%, that's all we need to do about 98% saturation for regular people. Okay. And so the other piece of hyperbaric therapy is we're increasing the amount of pressure that your body's under. Okay. Pressure at sea level is defined as zero, basically. And so when you're going at altitude, you're going to lower, you're going to higher pressure. And when you're going below sea level, you're going to lower pressure. In a hyperbaric chamber, we simulate the pressure you feel under a certain amount of seawater. Water is extremely heavy. It's that pressure that we simulate in the chamber. Okay. And that pressure itself drives oxygen into circulation by one physics law, the only physics law that I'll talk about on this podcast, called Henry's Law, which basically states the more pressure you put on a gas, the more of that gas is going to go from a gaseous form to a liquid form, in this case, oxygen. So as I mentioned, we're already saturated with 98% oxygen typically on our red blood cells. So what pressure does is it drives oxygen into the liquid of your bloodstream, the plasma of your bloodstream. So you can set, you can saturate up to about 1200% more oxygen in circulation as a result of putting pressure on the body. And so hyperbaric therapy is simply a combination of increased inspired oxygen and increased atmospheric pressure to drive more oxygen in circulation. And as a result of all that oxygen going in, 1200% or more, sometimes less depending on the pressure, which we can talk about because there's some variation there that we play with depending on where we want the oxygen to mostly concentrate. Typically, lesser pressure, so milder pressures, are better for neurocognitive optimization, and deeper pressures are better for full systemic, full body optimization. But there's some nuance there. But in general, all that oxygen is going into circulation, and then you have this huge amount of oxygen that creates this huge shift in our physiology, both acutely, immediately, and over the long term over a hyperbaric protocol. And so that's where the delineation really needs to be made in the sense of, are we using hyperbaric therapy for an acute indication for something that just happened, or are we using it more for a long-term indication or a chronic issue that really requires much more of a shift in your physiology from an epigenetics perspective, how your DNA is expressing your genes or suppressing genes, depending on what's required. So on the acute side of things, we're immediately getting a lot of oxygen in circulation. And as a result of that, you're reversing low oxygen states. So if you've had an acute trauma, acute heart attack, stroke, spinal cord injury, injury to your limb, for example, if you can get more oxygen to that tissue immediately, you're going to prevent some of that tissue downstream of that injury from actually dying. So this is really, really important, as you can imagine, from the acute side. And this is what I saw when I was in training, when I was in medical school, for example. Not only is it doing that, it's also decreasing inflammation, decreasing swelling. It's got antibacterial, antifungal, antiviral properties. It's releasing stem cells, and it's also increasing flow into tissue and lymphatic flow out of tissue. That's all happening immediately. And then over a longer protocol, over cumulative exposure of hyperbaric therapy over 10, 20, 40, sometimes more sessions, what happens is that you actually shift those epigenetics and you get new blood vessels. You get those stem cells that are maturing and creating new tissue in the areas that have been injured. You get inflammatory downregulation. So inflammation goes down, and all the inflammatory mediators like cytokines, for example, get downregulated, which is really important. You also get those stem cells are also really important, no matter where they go, right? It could be in your brain, it could be in your limbs, it could be anywhere, right? You're getting that. So those are the major delineations that I like to make and the basics of hyperbaric physiology.
Wow. I mean, yeah, hyperbaric is amazing. And I've been doing it for years. And like I mentioned, we have one at our clinic. And I agree with everything that you're saying. So talk about the difference between, so people can have a chamber at home,
right?
Or as we were just discussing before the podcast, there's a vast array, essentially, of different options for hyperbaric therapy. Can you walk through kind of the mild chambers, the soft chambers, what people might be more familiar with?
Sure.
What the application is, and then kind of work your way up into the like high grade super medical hyperbaric chambers.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. It's an important point. And what I've been trying to do, I think, over the last many years at this point is trying to make this delineation for people, mostly because there's a lot of information out there and it's difficult to navigate because you have the mild units on the market that go to about 1.3 or 1.5 atmospheres, the equivalent of about 10 to 15 feet of seawater pressure. And then you have the medical grade units that can go to those pressures, but then typically can go much deeper to 2 atmospheres, which is 33 feet of seawater, or even 3 atmospheres, which is 66 feet of seawater. And then you can go to a medical grade facility in a hospital or in some of these diving areas around the world where you can even go deeper than that in these submarine looking chambers called multi-place chambers. These are where multiple people can get treated all at the same time. In fact, hyperbaric therapy was developed and invented for diving injuries specifically. And as a result of the technology and the physiology and what they found, that's how it became more of a medical technology in the 1950s. Before there were bypass machines in cardiovascular suites in surgery, they used to use hyperbaric chamber rooms where they'd actually pressurize the entire room and then put somebody under the knife to do something with their heart because they would oxygenate better that way and they would survive and have better function afterwards, for example. But the key is in delineating the pressures, as you were describing, Caleb, because the mild units, 1.3 to 1.5, really is, it kind of has like two sides to the story. One is there's definitely some potential from the data that we have for neurocognitive optimization and neurocognitive injury recovery. So brain injury, stroke, people with other cognitive issues. But it's also on the other side of it is also really great for like a stacking sort of like biohacker kind of way where you can stack it with other types of technologies that help enhance the function of the chamber and the chamber enhances the function of those technologies. So these things like lights, for example, electric stim machines, cold therapy, hot therapy, you can use all these things together with the chambers themselves to help leverage the technology and help improve its function for things like recovery, muscle recovery from exercise or from just generalized recovery from fatigue and weakness, immune system dysfunction on the milder side of things. And so you have a lot of potential to use these chambers, but usually neurocognitive optimization and overall wellness with an emphasis on the stacking piece is really important. And then the medical grade units that go to deeper pressures, that's where most of the studies have been done. That's where you have studies that have been done on reverse aging, for example. You've had studies on like VO2 max improvements, studies on chronic pain syndromes, stroke, traumatic brain injury, others that have been used at the deeper pressures. Although stroke and traumatic brain injury also have some data at the milder unit pressures as well. So, but in general, medical grade units, you'll find mostly at facilities. And there are 4 insurance coverable indications for hyperbaric therapy. So if you have them, that are things that are done outside the hospital, at least. There's more that you can do if you're in the hospital. But outside the hospital, diabetic foot ulcers, so saving patients from amputations all the time if they get referred over. That's the other thing. But the radiation injury from cancer treatment. So if you've had a radiation and you get an injury from the radiation itself that doesn't go away, or it's something that pops up 6 months or longer after the radiation exposure, then at that point, hyperbaric therapy is fantastically effective at rebuilding and revascularizing and rebuilding the architecture of tissue. You also have chronic bone infections and sudden hearing loss. These are some other ones that you can use the hyperbaric chamber for that are insurance approved, that are usually used at deeper pressures. And then if you ever get cyanide poisoning, they're really great for that too, but I don't recommend it in general. Right. don't try that at home, ladies and gentlemen. But yeah, so that's the main delineation. So the mild units, neurocognitive optimization, great for stacking and wellness. And then like I have one in my house that I use in that capacity, for example. And then the medical grade units for more systemic optimization, faster results if you have a deeper tissue kind of thing that you're looking to recover from as well, or a major medical condition.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that. It's really important for us to be able to just understand what application makes sense where. So real quick, let's go over these stacks. So what would you recommend for stacking?
So it depends on what your goals are in general, but like the way I think about hyperbaric therapy is that you're getting a lot more oxygen in the system, as we discussed. And as a result of that, you're making more energy. You're making more ATP because oxygen's required. There's more oxygen in the system, the more energy that it's going to be made. But the question is, can you make energy effectively? So are you a good energy producer in the sense that is your electron transport chain working? Are you able to break down your macronutrients into electrons so that you're bringing them to your mitochondria? So you're making NAD and FAD, for example. And so thinking about all these kinds of things is probably already making your head turn as far as other things that you can do to try to stimulate the system to be making more energy effectively so that when you get the oxygen in there, that it's going to work as optimally as you can. So simple things like NAD, for example, might be interesting, right? Because if you're taking NAD, that's also going to rev up your system so that you're going to have more electrons going through, you're going to have more oxygen available, synergistic potentially, right? Or even understanding your foundational biology is really important. And this is kind of where I focused a lot of my practice now, my clinical practice, is looking at optimizing vitamins, minerals, nutrients, and making sure people can actually make energy effectively. Because if you can't, you're bringing the system a whole lot more oxygen, things can go south pretty quickly. You don't usually get in trouble in a mild unit, but in a medical grade unit, you can. And over time in a mild unit, you can as well, especially if your mitochondria aren't working that well in your brain, for example. So you can test for these things. And so what I'll typically do with my clients and the clinics that I work with is usually recommend some sort of optimal health kinds of comprehensive testing. This is not just your regular testing from your conventional doctor. This is like looking at vitamins, minerals, nutrients, micronutrients, et cetera. I use metabolomics in my practice. This is based on work that I've been trained in called Health Optimization Medicine in Practice, which is a nonprofit organization that's training doctors and practitioners like me on how to optimize health rather than treat disease using foundational health markers. But metabolomics is really what we focus on, and that's real-time cellular health markers of metabolism, or what's happening real-time in your cells that you can actually measure. So when I think about stacking, that's the first thing I think of is, can you make energy effectively? And then after that, I think of, how can you help make energy more effectively, right? So this is things like NAD or even B vitamins or something else that's going to help with the whole process of making energy. And then you can also think about, not only are you making energy effectively, but how well are you getting the oxygen to where you want it to go? And so this is when you can think of something like red light. Like red light therapy is going to dilate blood vessels in the area that you shine the light, and it's also going to stimulate energy production. It actually works on the electron transport chain, just like we were talking about before. And so you increase the amount of oxygen that is needed in that particular tissue. That creates something called an oxygen debt in the tissue. So that means that if you're creating a debt in the tissue, you're creating a stimulus for more oxygen to flow in that particular area. So that you can think about anything that's creating a debt in the tissue is going to create more tissue flow. So even if it's exercise right before, for example, or even if it's just using like a foam roller or like a ball or something, you're going to create more flow in that area. You're going to bring more oxygen to that area when you're in the hyperbaric chamber. So those are two things that I think about. Is I think about energy production and the ability to get oxygen to the area. And then I also think about what's happening from a lymphatic flow perspective, like how you're getting detox from that area after you've made all the energy. So this is really where like your saunas come into play, right? Or your PEMF devices, for example, where you can get microvascular flow post-hyperbaric therapy. So that those are kind of the framework that I use. There's all different types of technologies that we can talk about that you have, if you have specific interest in one or two, and I can talk about, you know, how that might stack with hyperbaric therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. So with red light, would you recommend doing red light first and then hyperbaric? So it creates the oxygen debt and then you jump in. Okay, great. Yeah. And then in terms of sauna or PEMF, you would do it after you do your hyperbaric session for the detox.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely the sauna. PEMF is a little bit, it depends on the PEMF device, I found. If it's a more, like if it's a very therapeutic PEMF device, if it's like one of your big coils, your big Tesla range, then I think beforehand might work well too. I've mostly used PEMF in like the home setting for people, and I haven't done a lot in clinics. And like typically the home units are better for like microvascular flow and detoxification. So that's how I think about using them. So typically it's lights first, and then sometimes even lights inside the chamber as well. If you have a mild unit, you can bring certain things in there as long as it's okay with the manufacturer, depending on the type of chamber that you're using. You have to ask the manufacturer first. But in general, you want to create the debt first and then go into the chamber to kind of harness that to get more blood flow to those areas. But on the other side of things, you can also think about, you know, getting a lot of oxygen in the chamber and then utilizing that oxygen post-hyperbaric therapy, because you get that oxygen in there, it stays for about 15 or 30 minutes. And so you have a period of time post-hyperbaric therapy. And by the way, during as well. So you can be doing brain games and brain training, and you're going to have more cognitive power and multitasking capacity when you're in there. There's some good studies on deeper chambers, at least for that. But post-hyperbaric therapy, when it's a little bit easier, obviously, to move around, you have 15 or 30 minutes where you have more oxygen in circulation. So you can do more cardiovascular work before you reach your anaerobic threshold as well. So this is something also to consider when you're doing additional training. If you're looking to create a further distance when you're going to hit your anaerobic threshold, you can do this with hyperbaric therapy because you have more oxygen in circulation. you can also bring in breathing techniques and other kinds of things to help with CO2, and then making sure that you have that piece that's also dialed in, because you don't want to hyperventilate in the chamber, because hyperventilating in the chamber is going to do something with it. It makes it so that oxygen doesn't unbind from your red blood cells as easily. So one of the things that you see a lot, and I'm sure you've seen a lot these days, is people doing a lot of hyperventilatory breathing. And I don't want people doing that in the chamber, because what happens is that you it looks like your oxygen levels are great, like you have 100%, but that's because they're not getting, the oxygen's not coming off your red blood cells. That's because you were breathing off a bunch of CO2. So anyway, that's maybe going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, but just to give you a feel that there's lots of things you can do. And what I was actually, what's really important, I think, to mention is that I was really bummed out maybe 4 or 5 years ago, because I was trying to tell people like this framework and trying to figure out ways to educate. And so I'd actually created a company, it's called One Base Health. And that company is actually creating protocols with these kinds of stacking things in mind, based on my clinical practice. It's a phone application right now, and it's going to have education, and we're also working on technology to integrate into some of these chambers as well, and to help with the ability to kind of use these things in a really cool way. And so, if people are interested, they can go to One Base Health and they can learn more about what we're doing. And at least on the soft chambers, we're creating the technology now, and the protocols to help integrate all these things together, which I'm super excited about.
That's amazing. Well, we'll have to look at some protocols too, like for my clinic. We of course do a lot of stacking here, but yes. We'll definitely love to look into what you would recommend. So what about NanoV? NanoV better before or after?
So yeah, I thought about this a lot. So, you know, NanoV itself is, it's interesting, right? So what it's doing is helping, it's giving you more antioxidant capacity. Right? Because at least that's what they say it's doing. That's what their studies are showing. So I think as a result of that, you want to be careful, because what hyperbaric therapy is doing by bringing all that oxygen in circulation is it's creating a hormetic stress. It's creating a stress in the body where you're making more reactive oxygen species. You're making more energy. So as a result of that, you're making more ATP. You're also making more carbon dioxide, and you're making more water. Plus you're making reactive oxygen species. That's all the waste or the byproducts of ATP metabolism or ATP production. So those reactive oxygen species in small amounts are really important for cell signaling and for epigenetic modifications in positive ways, okay? So if you're using NanoV too soon after hyperbaric therapy, I worry that you may be neutralizing some of the benefit. So just like if you were going to do, like if you just did exercise, you don't want to immediately go into a cryo chamber or into the cold tub, right? We know from pretty good data that you want to wait at least an hour or so that you let the exercise do its thing, do its hormetic thing, create the epigenetic stress or the epigenetic shift because of the stress that's happening. So the same thing happens, I think, in a hyperbaric chamber, just on the microvascular side of thing. It's like a microvascular, the pressure, the oxygen, it's creating exercise in the system. And so even if you don't feel it, you're just sitting there. Even if you're in a mild unit, I still hesitate by using it too close to being inside the hyperbaric environment as a result of that. There's a caveat though. The only caveat is if you're going in and you're chronically sick, if you have autoimmune problems, if you already have a lot of oxidative stress ongoing, maybe you did some laboratory testing and you saw how, you know, your antioxidant levels are in the tank and et cetera, then you may want to do additional antioxidant support when you're getting into the chamber, especially if you're going into a deeper chamber, so that you can actually benefit from hyperbaric therapy, but you don't, you know, get knocked on your ass for several days, which has certainly happened to patients of mine with Lyme disease and autoimmunity and things like that. If that stuff's not being addressed, they do better if you add some antioxidants beforehand, and something like NanoV and others can be really helpful in those cases.
Amazing. I agree with you on that. That's kind of where my thought process was as well. So, okay, we'll pull ourselves out of the super in-depth biohacking, like stacks, and let's talk about hyperbaric studies. So there's a lot of really compelling evidence for hyperbaric. Let's talk about some of your favorite studies. I mean, there's one for almost everything, for brain health. As you know, I trained under Dr. Daniel Amen.
Yes.
Hyperbaric oxygen therapy is one of his go-tos for any TBI, concussion, a lot of brain-related issues. So let's talk about the brain first, and then we'll move into some other things like telomeres and everything else that hyperbaric can offer.
Yeah, player's choice wherever you want to go, because there are so many studies here. The Israelis have been the biggest study producers over the last since 2017, actually 2013, almost 10 years now, they came out with their first study on hyperbaric oxygen therapy post-stroke as a way to recover from stroke. And so, but to stay on the brain injury side of things, they published a number of different studies here. It's been a little bit controversial, as always things are in this world. The challenge with studies in the hyperbaric world, this is changing, but it's difficult to have what we call a placebo-controlled trial in a hyperbaric chamber. And for those that don't understand this, this basically means you have somebody that gets the intervention and they have somebody that has the exact same demographic information, same sex, same age, same medical conditions or very close to it, and doesn't get the intervention. The challenge with the hyperbaric chamber is that ideally you would put them both in a hyperbaric chamber and you would have one person not have the chamber turned on and you have the other person with the chamber turned on getting treatment. But the problem with that is that the person that didn't have the chamber get turned on knows they didn't get hyperbaric therapy. Right. And so what they would do is a couple of things that they do. First, they'd have somebody that would get not hyperbaric, they wouldn't get into a hyperbaric chamber at all. And then they compare that to somebody that did get into a hyperbaric chamber. And, but the problem with that is that you couldn't tell if it was the hyperbaric chamber that was doing the work or just being in the chamber itself that was like resting and relaxing and healing or whatever, right? Was it the hyperbaric exposure itself or was it the chamber itself? So what they've done is they've become smarter at how to do these studies, but in general, what they did that wasn't smart is that what they used to do, and they still do sometimes, is they'll compare hyperbaric therapy at one pressure and one amount of oxygen to another pressure and more oxygen, and say that this is what's called a sham study, which means that the sham part is that, so what they'll do here is that usually that the sham control is somebody going to a chamber at 1.3 atmospheres with no added oxygen. Okay. So if you pressurize a hyperbaric chamber at 1.3, like the one you have in your chamber, Akilah, that's going to increase the amount of oxygen in circulation by 46%. That's without any extra oxygen at all. Okay. So you're already changing things by changing the pressure and changing the amount of oxygen in circulation. But the conventional hyperbaric world says that doesn't count for anything. Like that has no physiologic effect, which is untrue, but this is what they were using as their sham placebo control. And they were comparing that to a person getting hyperbaric therapy with 100% oxygen at a different pressure. And this is important for the brain injury studies, because what they saw on these brain injury studies is that in people that should not get better, okay, because these are people that have had brain injury for a long period of time, everybody got better, okay? And if everybody gets better, if your placebo gets better, your placebo in quotes, and your treatment arm gets better too, then it's all fake. Nothing happened because it was just a figment of the imagination, just being in the hyperbaric chamber. It had no effect basically because everybody got better. So, but the problem with that, as I was discussing, is that each of them were getting hyperbaric therapy just at a different dose with a different amount of oxygen and different pressure. And we know the brain specifically is very sensitive to oxygen, tension, and pressure. And so now more studies are being done. And we know that there is a significant difference there. We know that hyperbaric therapy is fantastically effective for traumatic brain injury at these milder pressures, 1.5, 1.3. And so that's why I feel pretty confident with the mild units that people have in their homes or in clinics, that they can be really helpful for neurocognitive optimization, because this was the sham control in these studies and everybody was getting better in them. And as a result of that, we know that there's something happening in those chambers. And we know that there, and I've seen this, you know, time and time again with people with neurocognitive issues, brain injury, stroke most commonly, that are doing very well in the milder unit pressures. So we know that for traumatic brain injury specifically, that there's good data to show that hyperbaric therapy anywhere between 1.3 to 2 atmospheres, a pretty wide range, can be very helpful in helping with recovery. This is not just one treatment in the chamber, though. We're talking about, you know, 20, 30, 40 sessions in the hyperbaric chamber, typically done Monday through Friday with the weekends off. And the reason for that is that that's the epigenetic shift that we were discussing before. It's the shift in how your DNA is expressing your various genes and the proteins that are transcribed as a result of that, that happens over this cumulative exposure of oxygen under pressure 5 to 6 days a week kind of thing. So some really good studies in traumatic brain injury. There's been studies in stroke, as we were talking about, as I mentioned briefly before. These are, again, in patients that should not get better. Like in the brain injury population, they took patients, the Israelis did, that were 1 year post-concussive syndrome. These are people that don't get better. They have symptoms that do not get better even after 3 months. And then they were getting better, which was amazing. And the same thing happened with the stroke study. Same thing. People with strokes 3 months to 3 years post-stroke, they do not get better post-stroke that this time frame for the most part. They were all seeing significant improvement, both in motor function and in cognitive function. The motor function got better, especially if it was 3 months post-stroke. 3 years, it was much harder to see motor improvements. And that's been my experience in clinical practice too. The longer you've waited to get into the chamber, the harder it is to recover. So, you know, in my perspective, like the faster people can get in there, the better, after they've obviously been stabilized and gone to the hospital. Like, don't go to your local hyperbaric facility if you're having a stroke or a heart attack, ladies and gentlemen, please go to the hospital. But after you get out, it's a really important way, I think, to help with recovery.
Absolutely. And you answered one of the big questions that I had was, because I think people will find it useful, is the protocol, you know. So
yeah,
agreed. Yeah. 5 sessions a week. And that's what we recommend as well. If you are really struggling with something, that's your aim. What about just for like cognitive clarity, like maintenance? Right. What do you recommend?
Yeah, this is what I built into the OneBase Health ecosystem, because the problem is that people don't know there's a difference, right? And I mentioned this a little bit earlier when talking about, is this an acute issue or is this a chronic issue, right? Is it, or an acute need for something or a long-term need for something? So if it's an acute need for something, like for example, a little bit of cognitive boost, a little bit of recovery, just got off a plane, I'm jet lagged. On a plane, by the way, you're pressurized to 8,000 feet. So you're at low oxygen up there. You're at low pressure. You get less energy production. One of the reasons why you feel like shit when you get to your location, even if you've not changed time zones. And that's another thing as well. But if you're doing it for something short-term acute, you don't need long hyperbaric protocols of multiple days and things like that. Even 1 or 2 sessions can make a huge difference. And I've seen this in my athletes that I work with. I mean, their recovery scores go through the roof after 1 hyperbaric session, post like a long day at the gym or exercising, whatever they were doing that day. So the short-term protocols can be 1 day, they can be 3 days, they can be 5 days. And then you start stacking them with other technologies, as I've been talking about. That's when you really can see some fantastic benefit in these short-term. But you're not going to see like that cognitive boost for more than a day or a couple hours or something like that. If you want to see long-term shifts and changes, that's when you need to do these longer protocols, because you're not just getting that acute oxygen exposure, you're also getting that epigenetic shift, that shift in expression of those genes. And now you're utilizing oxygen better, your inflammation's down, you're getting more blood flow to areas that you weren't getting blood flow to before. And that's sustainable, right? So the question always I get is like, what is that lever? What is that fulcrum where you start actually having those sustainable changes? And the answer is, we don't know exactly. Yeah, we think that from my experience and from the research out there, it's usually around 20 hyperbaric sessions, 2-0. This is at least in the deeper chambers where you're going the 2 atmospheres. But I think if you're just looking for like neurocognitive optimization, the 20 sessions in the mild units will probably do the same thing. And I'm working on doing some testing now with my company and others to kind of get a better sense of all that, to see exactly what that looks like. But I also think when you're like stacking things on top of this, right? If you're stacking, if you're optimizing health, if you're looking at a foundational framework, if you're then also giving things like vitamins, minerals, and nutrients, light therapy, other technology as well that might be helping with blood flow, with energy production, like you might be able to get there faster. I don't know. You know, this is the stuff that I'm continually working on with clinics that I consult with as well.
Amazing. Yeah. I get in there. It's actually an amazing office, the hyperbaric chamber, because mine is so big and then you can't get pulled a million directions. So, and what you're saying with the oxygen saturation, you think more clearly. Yeah. So like, I mean, I probably should be doing something a little bit more, you know, like brain games or something of that nature. But I mean, I power through emails when I'm in that thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes I do Zooms and people think I'm like in a spaceship, which is also kind of cool.
I had one podcast that I recorded in the hyperbaric chamber as well, but there's a little bit of a humming in the background. So, you know, but you're right. I love that the chamber can be anything you want it to be. Like in general, if you need to be more parasympathetic, it's a great place to do it, right? You can do your meditations in there. You can do your mindfulness practice there. But if you need to be active and working and, or learning, you know, then, or recovering or from an injury or even just from the day, like it's a great place to like watch game tape. If you're an athlete or if you're brain training, like neurofeedback before, or maybe even during, is extremely interesting. Definitely before, because we talked about how like a little bit earlier about this oxygen debt, the brain's the same way. So the brain is working real hard, like neurofeedback, for example, and then you go into a chamber right afterwards, all that oxygen is going to go preferentially to the areas that you just were working. So I've seen some really great saves and improvements in people with brain injury, in kids as well, that are using using neurofeedback along with hyperbaric therapy for things like ADHD and even on the autistic spectrum as well. Again, not in a silo, not just not eating McDonald's and having, you know, crappy food every day and not going to see doctors to help them, but in the context of optimizing health, I've seen fantastic benefits of just thinking about the chamber in a different way than most people would, right? And most people think, you know, like anything else, like there's a pill for that, like there's a chamber for that, like they're like, and you know, obviously I have a company that makes formulas that have pills, and those are great too, and they can be used, but the context is always really important for me when it comes down to how you're going to use these chambers, whether you're going to use a mild unit at a facility, at your house, a medical grade unit at a facility, or at your house, because you can do that too these days. I mean, and I work with people in all these contexts, people that have home chambers, people that have clinics like Ukulele that have multiple modalities and looking at how to optimally stack depending on the patient population. The options are really boundless when it comes down to what you can do now.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think about nutrients before a hyperbaric session? So we actually, we'll put patients in the chamber with an IV for better absorption. Mm-hmm. I've seen some data saying it can be up to even 6 times better absorption. Do you agree with that? Or should people maybe consider like doing some vitamins beforehand?
As long as you're not doing antioxidants, I think if you're using vitamins that are helping with energy production or anabolic types of things like amino acids, for example, I think that's a great idea. I think you have to be a little bit more careful when it comes down to anything that's going to produce an antioxidant response. So like things like glutathione or like some like minerals like selenium, for example, like I tend to not do before hyperbaric therapy unless there's a significant need as a result of their own baseline levels of oxidative stress. And then, like I was mentioning before, are my chronic Lyme patients, my autoimmune patients, patients that have chronic infections, even some of these post-viral people that we're seeing now, a lot of them actually, some of these people do need some antioxidant support. Interestingly, just as a point to this, the Israelis weren't mentioning, they weren't measuring any of this stuff, but they did find that if they gave NAC 30 minutes before hyperbaric therapy for their stroke patients, they had better outcomes. And this is not surprising probably to you and to me together, because most people are antioxidant deficient. Most people have a lot of oxidative stress, especially if you've had a stroke. I mean, you're already at, there's reasons why you've had a stroke, right? Most of the time, except if it was like a car crash or something. But in general, you've had a stroke because you have your protoplasm ain't up to snuff kind of thing. So like, as a result of that, it's indicative that there is a utility of giving antioxidants ahead of time, but understanding why and the person is really important. That's why I'm as data specific or as data focused as I can with my clients, you know, especially if you have a chamber and you're using it over the long term, like you have a chamber, you can use it anytime you want. People are getting chambers for their houses, which, you know, I do help people get and help with protocols. It's like, this is something you want to understand how you're going to use this thing over the long term, right? You don't want to use this thing every day. Like that's not a good idea, because for the reasons we were mentioning before, you can build up with reactive oxygen species and oxidative stress. So you want to be using it in protocols where you maybe are going in for maybe a month at a time, but then you're taking breaks or going 3 times a week and then taking holidays from going in. It's like, it's really important for the body to have an intermittent exposure to it over time and not regularly. One of the things I've come into, it's come to me a decent amount over the years, is that, yeah, I've been using my chamber for 6 months. I haven't stopped for one single day. I'm like, no, that's not what we do. And people are going to break this way, right? So like, and they'll tell me, oh, I really was feeling really good initially, and now I don't feel any good anymore. And like, that's another sign, just so you're aware, Kayla, for people that are coming in, is that if you find that people are doing really well and then all of a sudden they start feeling worse, like they're like some of their initial symptoms start coming back, that's usually a sign that they might be getting too much oxygen as well. So just as an oxidative stress marker, like that's something that I always consider as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that was on my mind quite a bit, actually, when you and I spoke at the biohacking conference.
Yeah.
Because there's people that are close to me and they get, you know, the type A people, they do something, they want to do it at the best of their ability, right? So like more equals better. And yeah, you and I are definitely on the same page with that, because you do want to not, you know, want to manage your oxidative stress. So no, I agree with that. So let's talk about the studies for anti-aging. I mean, obviously longevity is a big thing. So there's some interesting literature out there. What's your take on it? And can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So the Israelis took a population of 65-year-olds and above. They were all relatively healthy, maybe on a couple of medications, but nothing dramatic, no history of cancer, no history of heart disease, et cetera. And they basically did a cohort of them through a hyperbaric protocol where they did 60 hyperbaric sessions, over 3 months. And they did it Monday through Friday. Each chamber pressure was 2 atmospheres, which is the equivalent of 33 feet of seawater. And they were in the chamber for 90 minutes. And every 20 minutes, they got an air break, which means instead of breathing 100% oxygen, they were breathing 21% oxygen, so sea level oxygen. So the reason why they did that is there's some studies out there that show, number one, when you do that, you decrease the risk of oxygen toxicity, which we can talk about. Rare, but it can cause things like seizures or pulmonary issues, but very, very rare. The other reason to give those breaks of oxygen is that we think that the delta, the change from 100% oxygen to 21% oxygen at pressure is seen by the body like if you were going to altitude. And as a result of that, it stimulates something called hypoxic inducible factor, HIF-1 alpha specifically, that is produced when you're at altitude that helps with stem cell release, decreasing inflammation, and overall oxygenation is what it comes down to. So as a result, and so they use those therapeutically, so those air breaks, for both reasons, both the prevention of complications along with potential increased therapeutic value. Side note to that is we don't know if that's effective or helpful in a mild unit, because we're not sure if there's enough oxygen in those chambers to make that delta, make that change enough to have the same kind of stimulus or same kind of effect. But we don't know right now. But anyway, so back to the data. 90 minutes, 60 times, 3 months. And what they did is they used this population and they churned out a whole bunch of data on this population. They churned out one study on VO2 max increasing. They turned out another study on brain vascularization. So they saw how the brains of a 65-year-old shrink as we get older because the vascular system starts to deteriorate. And they saw a regeneration of that vascular system. They published a study on erections, great for guys. So it helped with vascular flow to the penis and helped improve erections, basically equivalent to what Viagra would do. Of course, Viagra is a pill you just take. This is something that you took 60 dives in a hyperbaric chamber. However, this is more sustainable, right? Because now you have vascular flow. And one of my favorite slides to show on lectures is a functional MRI or an MRI of the penis that shows blood flow, because nobody knows what it is. And everybody loves to hear the word penis when you're on stage, right? So I show a before and after of a penis before hyperbaric therapy and a penis after. You can't even tell. It just looks like a tube or something. But anyway, but it's a great visual to show what's happening throughout the whole body is happening in the brain. It's happening in your penis, if you're a guy.
You're going to have to send me this slide and we'll show it to our male patients before hyperbaric. They'll be much happier about going in there.
It's funny you mention it, because this is how the Israelis got there. So when I was in Israel in 2018 and I met them as they were doing these studies, and the primary researcher, his name is Dr. Shai Afradi. And I'm like, Shai, how do you get all these guys to sign up for being in the chamber for 60 treatments for 3 months of their life? He's like, I show them this picture.
that will do it, right?
So, so we don't have data on the mild units as far as causing the same kinds of things, systemic benefits. But I have indications from my own clinical practice and people that I work with that, especially, again, if you're looking at the foundational health markers, if you're stacking other therapies together, the spontaneous erections do happen in the mild chambers as well. That's for sure. But anyway, so the other piece of data that they published on this group of people was that they showed two different types of things. They showed, one, senescent cells. Those populations went down significantly. So senescent cells are these cells that build up in our body that don't work very well. They don't really do a whole lot, but they can cause inflammation. They're called zombie cells. That's sort of like the name for it that people might know. And they can cause, they give you a high risk of having cancer, degeneration, et cetera. So the population of these cells went down about 30%, which is pretty dramatic. There's very few additional other modalities out there that have shown something like this before. And so the maximum amount of senescent cell population decreases around treatment 30, which is also interesting. And then they also looked at telomere length. So telomeres are the ends of our chromosomes. These get shorter as we get older, and then eventually the chromosome gets unstable, then the cell kills itself. And so telomere length going up is potentially a sign of these of our cells, the cells that they tested specifically, being more on the regenerative side, you know, being younger per se. I'm not as convinced on the telomere length side of things, honestly, because there's a little bit of controversy on telomeres itself. Like telomeres also are bigger in cancer cells too, for example. So telomere length is not the end all be all. Senescent cell populations are really interesting to me though, because those we know have a direct correlation. In a hyperbaric chamber, I think what's happening, it's one of two things. Either these senescent cells are realizing that they're crappy and they're just sending out signals to kill themselves, which is called apoptosis. This is cells are supposed to do, or that they're regenerating themselves because hyperbaric therapy is regenerating their mitochondria. And then as a result of that, they're becoming normal cells again. You know, we don't know which one of them is happening. My guess is it's probably the latter, but I don't know for sure, which is regenerating their mitochondria and helping them work better. But in essence, that's the study and that's the population. And the great thing about this is that they didn't change their diet, didn't change their exercise, didn't do any stacking, of course, because you can't publish a study with any of that stuff going on, right? So the beauty for me is like, well, that took 60 sessions. What can I do in 20? What can I do with my clients and the facilities that I work with in 30, for example? And also, can we get some of the benefit even if you don't have a medical grade chamber? And the answer to all of that is that we absolutely have things that we can do. And I've seen clinically be very, very effective, despite maybe not even getting to that exact protocol.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I'm super hyped up about hyperbaric right now. And I definitely am going to do a session after our podcast today.
Me too.
So, okay. We've talked about brain health. We've talked about the anti-aging study. What are some of your other favorite applications, you know, backed by science to use hyperbaric for?
That's a really good question. So there's so many that I've used over the years that have just been so amazing to me. But again, it's always really important for people to realize it's not just about going into the chamber. I do a lot of consultation with people all over the world. And I often say that 80% of what I'm going to tell you has nothing to do with hyperbaric therapy at all. The last 20% will have something to do with the chamber, because the protocols are easy for the most part. You just, as you said, you get into a chamber, you relax. It's not inexpensive. That's true. So there is a cost thing here. And then depending on the type of chamber. But in general, if you have a long-term goal or you have a chronic issue, then going into the chamber immediately is probably not a good idea. And I get in trouble in the hyperbaric community for saying this because people want to put people in chambers, right? And I got disinvited for a lecture because I was going to actually, my lecture title was, "Do not put them in the chamber."
Yeah, I can see why they were probably like, we're going to hold off on you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But look, for me, I see the incentive. It's like, there was a great YouTube skit from like 20 years, not even 20, 15 years ago now, when I was in medical school. And I think it said it all, right? Doctors, or even, we're all kind of subject to, like, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? If you're a cardiologist, you're going to get an EKG, you're going to get EKGs on everybody. If you're a pulmonologist, you're going to get a chest x-ray, right? Like, you do the things that you do because this is what you do. So for me, it's like, let's take a step back. Let's do the 30,000 foot view here. You're coming into my office, or you're calling me because you have migraine headaches or something like that, right? Migraines suck. I got it. You want to get rid of them. Maybe the chamber can help you. But if you really want to see benefit over the long term, optimize your foundational health first. This is why I have my health optimization medicine practice, that I say, let's do this work first and then get you in the chamber 2 to 3 months later, after you've worked on that foundational stuff first, vitamins, minerals, nutrients, hormone optimization, whatever it might be, then that's when you're going to benefit the most. Now, in that in-between period, there are many things that you can do, of course. You can use things that work now that really help with mitochondrial function. And that's something like methylene blue, for example, which we can talk about, or other kinds of formulas that really can help now, right? But in that, the beginning part is really important to work on that part that's really going to be that foundation for you as you're going into the chamber. So when it comes to like some of the chronic things that I've really worked with and had a lot of great success in the chamber, like Lyme disease is a great one. Like, Lyme disease is really challenging. It's multifactorial. There's so many aspects to this as well. But if I put you in the chamber too early, you are not going to do well. I often say that if you're going to do well in a hyperbaric chamber with Lyme, you need to be about at least 60% better already, or maybe up to 80%. And then typically you need to go into the deeper chambers too. The mild units are going to be okay for like some of the neurocognitive things from Lyme, but they're not going to be great for the systemic Lyme killing side of things. And also some of the other bugs that can go along with Lyme, like your Bartonella or your Babesia, these are also oxygen savvy bugs. So a little bit of oxygen might be okay for them. And you got to be worried about them potentially getting worse, or at least not getting any better inside of a mild unit, for example. So like Lyme has been a great one over the years, but it really does take a lot of work. I've also had people with early, with mild cognitive impairment, or even to the Alzheimer's dementia, even Parkinson's do really well in the chamber. I've had people with chronic pain syndromes do really well as well. So like, this is like, it's called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, or complex regional pain syndrome is the other name for it. Like even your fibromyalgias, your chronic fatigue, like I've had a lot of great success with these patients over the years, if they do some of these other things beforehand. If you're just going into the chamber thinking that it's going to be the only thing that's going to work for you, unlikely, especially if you have some of these more chronic issues like chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, even on the dementia side of things. Like I've seen some benefit even in people that haven't done some of the other work, but it's usually not as significant and it's usually more short-lived. So the challenge with my field, I think, is that we get so focused on putting people in chambers that we forget that people can't go in chambers all the time. The caveat to that there may be roles for maintenance therapy for a lot of people, even if they're optimizing, because maintenance might be great for people that have chronic issues that are not going to completely get better, for example. And so if you've had a brain injury that's not going to completely get better, being in a hyperbaric chamber regularly, I think, is beneficial. I don't have data on that, but from a clinical perspective, it seems to be. So anyway, long story short is, what I think about here, Kayla, always is, what is hyperbaric therapy doing? It's decreasing inflammation. It's getting more stem cells to release. It's antibacterial, antimicrobial, and it's reversing low oxygen states. So that's why I often say after that, it's not if hyperbaric therapy is going to be helpful for you, it's when. And the when is the key here. And then the when and the how, basically, is the two things that I would say there, because it's not just the when, but the how, in the sense of what's your protocol, what's your pressure, what are you stacking, et cetera. What are you doing all together to really make it, you know, the treatment that it can be, and to reach its potential with what you want.
Absolutely. I agree with that completely. And, you know, when my partner and I, we decided to build this clinic, we thought the exact same way. So we do a lot of functional medicine, you know, either first or in combination, see what's actually happening in your body. So it can't just be just like one thing in isolation is never the best approach. So right. I completely agree with that. And we're totally on the same page. So yeah, I mean, hyperbaric is amazing. I mean, obviously we've spent about an hour talking about all the benefits and we haven't even scratched the surface, to be honest. I mean, we could talk about this for much longer, but I do want to talk about methylene blue. So methylene blue is a big hot topic right now. And you have a company called Troscriptions. Super unique and incredible formula for methylene blue delivery. But talk about methylene blue, what it is, some of the, you know, it has an interesting background in terms of what its application was and what it even is used for sometimes in the ER these days. So can you give us a little bit of background on methylene blue?
Yeah. Methylene blue is a fantastic compound. It's got a long history. It was the first drug registered with the FDA back in 1893, I believe. And the first medical indication was actually for malaria. I don't know how they got from dying blue jeans with this particular compound. That's what they used to do. It's a malaria treatment. It's unclear in South Africa what drugs they were on to be able to figure that out, honestly. But they somehow figured out that malaria was fantastically responsive to methylene blue. And then over the next several decades, it became one of the go-to antimicrobials because there was nothing else that existed at the time. So it was great for urinary tract infections, for parasitic infections, for fungal infections, for yeast infections. And it was used throughout and up until World War II. And World War II pilots had to carry around methylene blue when they were in the Pacific to treat things like the things that I just described. And they had songs about methylene blue as well, because methylene blue concentrates in your urine. So as a result, your urine's going to turn blue as a result of taking methylene blue. Now, it's interesting though, Kayla, because I think, and we can talk about the nuances here, but the pigment, the color of your blue, how blue your urine is, may be an indicator of how much stress your body's under as well. So the more blue it is, the less stress, the less blue, the more stress, because methylene blue after the 1950s fell out of favor as being an antimicrobial because we had other things now. It's come back into play now, actually, interestingly enough, because all the antibiotics or the anti-malarial pills are all resistant to malaria now. All malaria is resistant to them. So now methylene blue is coming back in as another treatment for malaria now over 100 years later. But in general, it became out of favor. And the first antipsychotic drugs were actually derived from methylene blue, interestingly enough, something called chlorpromazine. Is that it? I'm forgetting the name. That's not chlorpromazine. It's another one. I'll think about it in a minute. Anyway, so the first antipsychotics were derived from methylene blue because methylene blue was found to be what's called a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, which means it prevents the breakdown of certain neurotransmitters. And so as a result of that, it gives you a little bit of a mood lift when you take methylene blue because some of those neurotransmitters are being released at higher levels. In addition, after that, it was found to be a stain. So they use it in laboratory staining to stain mitochondria. And that's specifically where it stains in the mitochondria. In the cell, in the mitochondria specifically. And what it's doing in the mitochondria now that we know this in the last several decades is that it's increasing energy production and it's also increasing antioxidant reserve at the same time. So it works on one of the complexes in your mitochondria called complex 4. And complex 4 is called cytochrome oxidase. And this complex gets revved up or increased as a result of methylene blue being around. As a result of that, you make more energy, you make more ATP. And at the same time, methylene blue is what's called an electron cycler because it actually picks up free electrons like reactive oxygen species that you make when you make energy. And so as a result of that, you're neutralizing like you would with antioxidants that you were taking. So there's very few compounds out there that do both, that increase energy production and also increase antioxidant reserve. So over the last several decades, there's been a lot of studies that have been done, mostly not in humans, but some in humans, that have looked at mitochondrial optimization using methylene blue, both in stroke, in ischemic strokes mostly, and traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's models, and also in normal people as well, normal patients that there's also seems to be benefit as well.
Amazing. Yeah. I think methylene blue is incredible. So talk about your delivery mechanism. It's a troche because there's like drops, there's all sorts of different ways. So talk a little bit about your delivery mechanism and how it might benefit people.
Yeah. So we use something called a buccal troche, or a troche is the other way to say it. They're these dissolvable lozenges. They're squares, but they're scored. So you can break them up into a quarter, a half, or a full. The thing about our company is that it came out of a nonprofit organization that we started to train doctors and practitioners called Health Optimization Medicine in Practice. And we were talking about earlier is that there needs to be like a gap for people to fill that gap when you're looking to help somebody, but it's going to take a little while to help them. You need something to help them right now. Methylene blue is a fantastic way to do that because it's supportive. It's going to help mitochondrial optimization. And most of us these days have some element of mitochondrial dysfunction just because of living in society as we live it in these days. And so we set up Troscriptions as a company to create formulas that filled that gap, that what you can do now to help yourself optimize. And so methylene blue, specifically in a troche form, dissolving your mouth, and all the troches that we have as a result of them dissolving in the buccal cavity up here, the top of like your cheek between your upper gums and your cheek, is that it dissolves directly into your brain circulation. So as a result of that, you're going to get circulation into the brain much faster as a result of it going from the buccal cavity. And in addition to that, the nice thing about it is it also bypasses something called first pass metabolism in your liver, which means that most things that we eat or the supplements that we take are going to get inactivated to some degree by your liver. Okay. And this is like a common example is NAC we were talking about before. NAC taken orally is about 10% bioavailable. So you swallow NAC, you took a 600 milligram pill, only 60 milligrams of that is actually getting into the body. So the nice thing about troches is it bypasses all that and it goes directly into your brain circulation. The cool thing about methylene blue though, in addition, is that even if you decide to swallow it, if you don't want your mouth to be blue, that's okay too. It's actually 100% bioavailable just about, even if you swallow it as well. So it's unique in that particular property of the compound itself. But we decided on the troches because it would hit the brain faster regardless. And it was very easy to titrate. So the dosing of methylene blue is very important. Higher doses, greater than 1 mg/kg, tend to be more not on the health optimization side of things, but on more on the treatment side of bacterial, viral, fungal, and then acutely acute mitochondrial dysfunction, like ischemic kinds of things. Okay. On the lower side, where we have our troches at 16 milligrams, somewhere between 8 and 16 is really the sweet spot, we believe, for some of the data out there, for mitochondrial optimization, health optimization, especially nootropic optimization. So for your brain function specifically. So that's what we decided on the troche at this particular dosing. And then we have a stack of methylene blue along with plus nicotine, caffeine, and CBD. This is something we call blue canatine. And this is a great stack for focus, productivity, you know, getting things done. It's your, like, it's your, without the jitters, without the withdrawal, without the crash that might happen with some of these other things that you could take. And it's about 3 to 5 hours. And that has the caffeine and nicotine in there, which are stimulants. The key with methylene blue, we created its own category. So Dr. Ted Achacoso, he's the founder of Troscriptions. He's a master formulator. And the key with nootropics in general for people is to realize that not all nootropics do the same thing, right? Some are going to be more healthy. Some are going to be more performance oriented. So we have three categories. We have health optimization nootropics, performance optimization nootropics, and bluetropics. Okay. Health optimization nootropics are ones that support the brain or the body to be healthy, but they're healthy for you. Something like L-tyrosine, for example, which helps with your neurotransmitters, is a great example of that. Performance optimization tropic, caffeine, nicotine. These are going to stimulate the system to work harder, make more energy, but they're clocking the system as well. Methylene blue does both. So we call it a blue tropic. It helps support the system, helping make more energy. It helps with antioxidant reserve, but at the same time, it's also helping with neurotransmitter release. And it's also got some performance related aspects to it too. Something like caffeine and nicotine are on the performance side, for example, right? So, but health optimization, sorry, the bluetropics, methylene blue is a bluetropic because it does both. So, and then the bluetropic stack to add an additional is the methylene blue plus the nicotine, caffeine, CBD. So you got everything all to combine together in some beautiful combination of amazingness to make your brain, you know, feel amazing and on fire for 3 to 5 hours. So.
I love that. And I've used them on multiple occasions. So big fan. Actually, by the time that this podcast comes out, we should try to get me like a code if I don't have one.
Yes,
like
we'll get Kayla, you one. Yeah.
Kayla or something. So
yeah,
we'll you guys you can order them and try them. It's a great way to, you know, really get into methylene blue, great for energy production. You know, mitochondrial function is all the rave these days. So
it is.
The big question is can you do hyperbaric and methylene blue at the same time?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we're still working on this now, but it depends on the patient. It depends on the person. In general, because methylene blue is a pretty powerful antioxidant at the same time as making energy, I tend to shy away in people that are looking to get significant performance-related gains from the chamber. If it's a recovery perspective, then I think absolutely they can be used together. So like if you're using it like to recover from a workout, from jet lag, from the immune system's not working so well, absolutely, I think they can be used together. I think it's also really helpful for people that have a lot of ongoing oxidative stress ahead of time. So if they're already stressed, like their immune system's already, you know, already down, if they're already oxidatively high, then I think using methylene blue beforehand is a good idea. Now, but if you're looking for performance related gains, then that's when I would probably wait and probably use it in like an hour to two after being in the hyperbaric chamber. But the other thing about methylene blue that's really interesting and important is it's also activated by red light. So the combination of methylene blue plus red light both works on the mitochondria in a very similar location. But you have photons and electrons that are combining. And then, so I think if you're using those together, along with some methylene blue plus red light, then getting in the chamber, it's like an amazing recovery stack, basically, because you're getting more energy produced, and you're getting more energy where you need it because you're shining the light where you need it to go. And then you're getting to the chamber, getting the oxygen in there and helping with flow as well. So there's some nuances there, but in general, I combine hyperbaric therapy with methylene blue, but I would say the majority the times if it's recovery focused. And then if methylene blue is coming in, almost always red light to activate it as well, or just getting in the sunlight if you have that where you are in the world.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. We do some methylene blue drips. We put them in the red light.
Oh yeah, nice.
After and
nice.
Your mitochondria is really up and at them. So yeah. Yeah. This has been an incredible conversation.
Thanks, Kayla. Yeah, one thing on the troches too is that they're titratable too, so that you can start off with a quarter or a half or a full, depending on what your dosing is, and you can kind of titrate to what you need. Like I'm a clinical practitioner, you guys have probably figured that out. And so all the trochees that we make, we all test and we all use clinically in our practices. There's four docs on my team. And so we're all pharmaceutical grade too. You have to make sure you're getting good methylene blue sources. Methylene blue can be in fish tank cleaner, but it also can be pharmaceutical grade and everything in between. So we get it from a supplier that third party tests it, and then we get it ourselves and we test it again to make sure it's clean. And we test our final products to make sure the potency is all what we want it to be as well. So we're really heavy on the making sure the quality is as top notch as we can get it for what we're doing. So, but yeah, it's a fantastic tool. Methylene blue can be used in almost any context, really. And that's the nice thing about it. It's really a great mitochondrial optimizer. And just always want to consider what else you're doing, of course, and what else what your goals are. So, but like, especially with the chamber, recovery is a great synergistic combination of the two things together.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the details on hyperbaric and, methylene blue. So definitely you guys can reach out to Scott's company. We'll include a link in the show notes for ordering transcriptions. And hyperbaric, I mean, it's a little bit more difficult to access, but I have a clinic that offers it. And then you can usually just search, hyperbaric chambers near me.
I also have options for people too. My company is doing some chambers for people to do some of the testing with us as we work on our technology. So if people have interest, I'm a pretty good gatekeeper. I have a team that's pretty good gatekeepers to help you understand what's best out there on the market to be able to help, with your goals really. And that's the keys. Unfortunately, if you call a chamber company, they're going to say it's going to help you, but that's not always the case, right? Depending on what your goals are, what your needs are and things like that. So yeah, I'd encourage people, they can head on over to, I guess, probably my company, One Base Health. That's if you have interest in chambers, and then it's onebasehealth.com. And then my personal consulting is drscottscherr.com. So drscottscherr.com. And that's where you can find information about consulting with me. And as I mentioned, I work with clinics. I work with people all over the world. I have clinics in Dubai and Adelaide, Australia, and South America that I work with, and in the US, of course, as well. So happy to also have those conversations. And then, yeah, Transcriptions is at transcriptions.com and on Instagram at transcriptions. And yes, Kayla, you will have a code. I will make sure of that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And yeah, thank you again. Hacking was created and is hosted by Kayla Barnes. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and views expressed on this podcast are not medical advice. This podcast, including Kayla Barnes, does not accept responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of the information contained herein. Opinions of their guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. If you think you have a medical issue, consult a licensed physician.